असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्युर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ शांति शांति शांतिः ॐ लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल लीड अस फ्रॉम डार्कनेस एंड टू लाइट लीड अस फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमॉर्टैलिटी ॐ पीस 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 गुड मॉर्निंग एंड नमस्ते एवरीबॉडी Very nice weather. I've been getting concerned emails from across the world. Like, are we still above water? The way the news has been shown across the world, it's like we are all drowning. So I said to them, no, it's very nice. The downpour has ceased and we are still above water. And it's a sunny day here in Manhattan. So, you are limitless, that's the subject today. And what we are going to talk about, where this comes from, is there's this text called Advaita Makaranda, which translates roughly as the nectar or the honey of non-duality. It's a very sweet name, the honey of non-duality. It's a relatively minor text, and it was written by this poet, Lakshmidhara Kavi. A few hundred years ago. Now the uniqueness, I mean, besides it being very poetic, because he was a Sanskrit poet, so the language is wonderful. But besides that, the real uniqueness of this text, which is a minor text in the whole canon of Advaitic literature, but the uniqueness of this text is, it's entirely based on reasoning. It aims to convince us through reason that right here, right now, you are Brahman. And therefore it is all right. Reflect on that, you see how we are beyond sorrow. You are beyond sorrow, beyond suffering. You are ever fulfilled. You are complete, Purnam. And not just as a claim, not just as something that one would like to believe in, but also as something that we can actually understand now and come to see, hopefully come to see right here, right now. Especially in today's age, this is worth thinking about, because we are in an age of reason, we are in an age of skepticism, we would like to understand. We do not wish to proceed down a spiritual path without clarity, without understanding, without proof. The philosopher Hume said that any claim requires proof, and extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. So something like God or something extraordinary like you are Brahman, it requires extraordinary proof. It requires to be grounded in experience and reason. It should be perfectly clear to us. And that's the big goal that this author has set for himself. He wants to demonstrate to our satisfaction that not only are you not this body-mind, but you are limitless, immortal consciousness. And from that perspective, you know, all of life's issues and problems, they take a radically different color and implication. More specifically, the author, the strategy of this author is, at the very beginning of the text, he says, I am Brahman. How? Because I exist. I shine, and never am I not dear to myself. This existence, this shining nature, and this always dear to myself, this is Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss. And when we look at the texts, Vedantic texts, Brahman, the ultimate reality, is defined as Sat Chit Ananda. I see that I am Sat Chit Ananda, so how am I not Brahman? And then what he does is, throughout the rest of the text, he takes up objections. We say, yeah, I mean, you exist, but that's not the point. Brahman is immortal existence. Brahman is not born, does not die. You are born and you die, so how are you Brahman? Like this, we'll have multiple questions. And he deals with those questions as they arise and shows us an answer to those questions. It gives us clarity about how you are immortal, actually. So he starts off by saying that aham asmi sada bhami kadachid naham apriyah. I am, I always shine, at no point am I not dear to myself. Ato aham katham na brahma, how am I not Brahman? Satchidananda lakshanam, which is defined as existence, consciousness, bliss in all the texts of Vedanta. And then we have doubts about it. We say, yeah, I exist, but this existence is limited existence. How can this be Brahman? Now, what we will do today is take up a little bit of the arguments which are presented by Lakshmidhara Kavi and try to understand this, especially in the context of limits and limitlessness. See, what he is referring to is that in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Brahman is defined as Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Brahman is infinite or limitless existence consciousness. Satyam, existence, truth, reality, existence. Jnanam, knowledge, consciousness, awareness. And Anantam, limitless. So what's the ultimate reality of this universe? Limitless existence consciousness. Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam Brahma. We shall first try to understand what is meant by limit, what is meant by limitless, and finally the arguments to show that I am limitless, you are limitless. So that's the subject today. Also, already what we have done is what the author means by you. What the author means by you is this very existence shining nature, this awareness which we are. That's what he means by you. And that he will reveal to be limitless. So, the definition of Brahman, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, your limitless existence consciousness. Now, we shall first explore what is meant by limit, and then we shall see what is meant by limitless, and how the arguments for showing that we are limitless. So, this is the plan for today. It's a big, big task, because I exist. I shine means, yeah, I am shining a little bit now, but that shining means I am revealed to myself. I am evident, my own existence is evident. And I am dear to myself, but how is this existence without any limit? How is this consciousness without any limit? That's what we must try to understand. So what is a limit? In Vedanta, limit is of three kinds. There are three ways in which we or any entity is limited. Limited in space, limited in time, and limited by object. And I'll explain each one. Limited in space means, the Sanskrit word is desha paricheda. Limited in space. Cheda means to cut. Paricheda, we're cut off in space. It's pretty easy to understand. Any physical entity which exists in space is located in space. Location means it's in a particular coordinate in space and not anywhere else. So I am here means I am not there. You are sitting in the chair means that you are not here. We are all here in this hall means we are not in the park. So we are located. If you are in one place, you cannot be in another place. You cannot be everywhere. So this is one kind of limitation because we have to be only located. No matter how big a creature is, even a blue whale, which is the largest living animal, it still has a location and, you know, only one place where it is swimming. So, we are located in space. But suppose there is some entity which is not located in space, which is not limited in space, then what will happen to it? See, limited in space means here and not anywhere else. Unlimited in space would mean it is everywhere at the same time. There will be no place where it is not. If you say Brahman is not limited in space, that means Brahman must be everywhere. Or you are not limited in space. In that case, you must be everywhere, not just here. So that's the task before the author. He has to prove that you are everywhere. It's a big deal, and to convince us. And he will, you'll see. In Sanskrit, desha paricheda shunya, devoid of or empty of the limitation, space limitation, means all-pervading. In Sanskrit, sarva-vyapi. In English, it is omnipresent, present everywhere, in case you are not limited in space. The second kind of limitation is limitation in time. Everything, every entity, every process in this universe has a beginning and an end. We have beginnings and ends. We feel that I was born on such and such date, and we will die on a particular date. You just have to go to a graveyard and a cemetery and see, you know, birth and death from there to there. One Swami joked, the date of birth, date of death, in between there's a dash. So our lives are basically a dash from the womb to the tomb. That is limitation in time. We are limited in time. This talk, very soon it will feel it's unlimited in time, but I assure you, even the longest talk has a limitation in time. It has a beginning and an end. So all entities, from the tiniest little insect to the stars and galaxies themselves, they have beginnings and ends. Just by the way, it's not relevant, but an interesting factoid I read just a couple of days ago. Galaxies. So the most powerful telescope which we have now is called the James Webb Telescope. It's out there somewhere midway between the Earth and the Moon or something, or beyond that even, beyond the Moon's orbit. And the latest discovery it has made is galaxies so far out that they shouldn't exist. They are so far away, and far away means millions of light years away, which mean millions of years in the past. So at that point in the history of the universe, you should see only things which were, you know, products of the Big Bang, very early in the history of the universe. There shouldn't be well-formed large galaxies like our own Milky Way. And they found more than 1,000 such galaxies. So, which means our understanding of the universe is not quite right, and some majorly flawed. Probably universe may be much, much older than we think it is. So, everything is limited in time. Birth and death, production and destruction, beginning and ceasing, from the tiniest microscopic creatures to vast astronomical entities. And us too. Our bodies, we have a beginning and an end. One Swami, he told us this funny story. He was in India, then he went out to another country, actually to South Africa. And there's little differences between the way we use English in India and the way English is used in other parts of the world. So he told this story. He was telling a very sad story about, and you know, very moving, sad, inspiring story about a monk who passed away. And he said, the last day of his life, I was racing to the hospital to see him because it seemed he will not survive. And the moment I reached the hospital, you know, the bed where he was, he had already expired. And then everybody burst out laughing in the hall. And the Swami said, but why did they laugh? I mean, it's such a sad story. And then somebody explained to him, Swami, expire means like medicines expire, vegetables expire, human beings don't expire, human beings die. So that's not how you use expire in South Africa, in the English spoken there. But everybody does expire, medicines and us too. So there is a time limit. It's called kala paricheda, limited in time. But suppose now something is limitless in time, which would mean there is no beginning, no end. There was never a time when it was not, and there will never be a time when it will not be. There will be no birth, no death. If you are limitless, then you do not have a limit in time. That's the claim. In which case, there was never a time when you did not exist. There will never be a time when you will not exist. That's the meaning of limitless in time. In one word, in English, eternal. You would become eternal. In Sanskrit, nityam. Nityam means eternal. Beginningless, endless. If something does not have a limit in time. Another type of limit is an interesting limit. It's called limit in object. Limit in object. What is limited in object? It's an interesting concept. It means everything is limited to being what it is and it's not something else. It means this clock is a clock. But it's not a podium, it's not the altar, it's not a flower, it's not the Swami, it's not any one of you. It's just a clock. It's identical to itself and different from everything else. It's different from everything else. Now, this is a kind of a limit. It can be only itself, poor little thing. It can't be anything else. Now, suppose something does not have this object limitation. In Sanskrit, vastu paricheda, object limitation. What will happen? What will happen if something does not, something has an object limitation, it's only itself and different from every entity in the universe, separated from every entity in the universe. But something does not have an object limitation, then it will not be different from everything else in the universe. There will be nothing in the universe different from it. If you do not have the object limitation, a Brahman does not have the object limitation, then there is nothing in the universe different from Brahman. There is no second entity apart from Brahman. That's the claim. If the there is something else apart from Brahman, then it limits Brahman, because there will be something that Brahman is not. But if Brahman has no limit, then everything must be Brahman. There cannot be anything apart from Brahman. There cannot be any second entity apart from Brahman. No second is equal to non-dual, is equal to, in Sanskrit, advaitam. The object limitation implies duality, plurality, multiplicity, difference. No object limitation implies non-duality. If an object is limitless with respect to all other objects, then it is non-dual. There can be no second entity apart from Brahman. In fact, whatever appears to be a second entity, whatever appears to be different from Brahman, must be in reality nothing other than Brahman itself. So non-duality, advaitam. Now let's sum it up. What are the limits? Space limit, time limit, object limit. In Sanskrit, desha paricheda, kala paricheda, vastu paricheda. Suppose a thing is unlimited, Brahman is unlimited, then what will happen? It has no desha paricheda, no space limit, no time limit, kala paricheda, no object limit, vastu paricheda. What is the implication? It will become all-pervasive, one, sarvavyapi, omnipresent. It will become eternal, nityam. And it will become non-dual, advaitam. Brahman, if it is Brahman, Brahman must be, to be limitless, Brahman must be all-pervasive, eternal, and non-dual. Sarvavyapi, nityam, advaitam. So far, so good. And if I am Brahman, then I must be all-pervasive, I must be eternal, I must be all-pervasive, and I must be non-dual. The moment the author claims, I am Brahman, I exist, I shine, and I am dear to myself, existence, consciousness, bliss, so how am I not Brahman? Our immediate reaction should be, wait a minute, Brahman, we'll take the eternity first. Brahman is supposed to be eternal. Are you eternal? Weren't you born on such and such day? Didn't the Swami just say the author lived several hundred years ago? Which means the author is cut off in time. How can you be Brahman? How can you be eternal? You are born and you die. You're born and you age and you die. Like every other entity in this universe. And how can you be eternal? So let's take that up first. The author wants to show that I, the consciousness, not the body, I, this awareness which I am. And this part of it, the awareness part of it, I will not belabor this point, because this is something basically I've been saying in almost every Vedanta class, that we are this awareness. All right, let me belabor the point a little bit, just a little bit. But let me approach it in a rather elegant way, not the usual, I'm not the body, not the mind, not like that. Notice that we are effortlessly aware of our own existence. What do I mean by that is, to know that you exist, to certify that you exist, I need to see you. That you are here, how do I know? I saw you. But the same doesn't apply to me. I am here, do I say, I am here? And if you ask me, how do you know? Will I say, I see myself, so I am here. That the such and such person was here, how do I know? Somebody else told me. That I was here, how do I know? Somebody else told me. No. So to certify to my own existence, I don't have to rely on my sense organs. I don't have to see myself, touch myself, ask somebody else. No. But to certify something else's existence, we need to depend on organs of the sense organs. But to certify one's own existence, one does not depend on any kind of sense. Yeah, come on up here. Please come. Which is a rather interesting state of affairs. This is what is called swaprakasha, self-luminous, self-revealed. And you, the consciousness, not only you are self-revealed to yourself, but you also certify the existence of everything else for yourself. It is only the whole universe, everybody else and everything else, including the body, including thoughts, they are all revealed to you, the consciousness. So this is what is meant by the shining nature. But this shining nature must be, limitless, all-pervasive. So this has to be shown by the author. I'll run through the arguments, compact, but we have to really be attentive. Walk with me. Follow me. I'm reminded of this little thing I remember from Tintin comics. We used to read them as kids in India. And there was this professor, Calculus. His name was Professor Calculus. Now, in one of those comics, he's explaining a nuclear fission reaction. And there is Tintin and Captain Haddock and the Thompson twins. If you know who I'm talking about, you know. If you don't know, it doesn't matter. It's still just they're following the professor. And Captain Haddock doesn't understand any of this nuclear fission stuff. He's scowling. He has a fierce scowl on his face, and he's right behind the professor. And the professor says, "Are you following me?" And the captain said, "Of course, we are right behind you." No, not in that way. We must walk together. This is a network of very elegant and interesting arguments here, which are going to be given. You have to understand them first, what the author is trying to say. And the more philosophically trained you are, the more interesting, controversial, and difficult you'll find these arguments. And then not only understand it, actually see for ourselves whether that is true or not. So this is like really will stretch our minds. First, let us take up the argument for unlimited in time, limitless in time. Brahman is eternal. Are you eternal? We ask the author, you said you are Brahman. Are you eternal? And the author says, yes. And the way he goes about trying to prove it is to show that you, this awareness, you are indestructible. If you cannot be destroyed, you clearly exist. And if you cannot be destroyed, then you must be eternal. How does he do that? He says, destruction is possible in three ways. Any entity can be destroyed in one or more of three ways. What are these three ways? Swataha, by itself. A thing can be destroyed by itself means, for example, we say, died of old age causes. Died of old age causes. Or expired. What is the reason for this illness? Oh, old age disease or old age causes. So by itself, entity finally, breaks down or disappears or whatever. Another way of destruction would be anyataha, by something else. So someone can get hit by a car or drowned in a flood or, an animal can get eaten up by another animal. So by something else, by the action, we can be killed by a tiny little virus. So by the action of something else, it didn't die by itself, by something else, anyataha, from something else. And then another way of destruction would be ashraya nashat, by the destruction of its environment, its support, its foundation. We talk about, the environment or the loss of life, so many species are disappearing because their environments are being destroyed. So our existence also depends on I get air and I get warmth, I get protection from the elements in this house. If the environment is destroyed, then this body will not survive. If you are suffocated, if you are starved, if you are subjected to earthquakes and floods, so then the entity will die. So these are the three ways in something can die. This is his analysis. By itself, by something else, or by something fundamental being taken away on which you depend. And then he shows how each of these will not work, will not destroy consciousness itself. So first one is very interesting. Swataha, by itself. And he says, no. Na swataha pratyabhijnanat. Because of recognition. Because of recognition. What does he mean here? How would consciousness be destroyed by itself? Let us look at the possibilities. Here, there are three possibilities according to some commentators. One is, the most important example is the Buddhist school of the mind-only school. The mind-only school in Mahayana Buddhism, the Sanskrit name for that is Kshanika Vijnanavada, the school of momentary consciousness. So what they say is, consciousness is destructible. In fact, its very nature is destruction. Every moment consciousness arises and the next moment consciousness is gone. So every experience comes as a package, as a flash. All our experiences, they come as a flash. Each one comes as an instantaneous flash. What does that experience consist of? Two things. Flash of consciousness and the object. So, right now, I'm seeing you. Right now, at this moment, there's a flash of consciousness and it reveals this for me. Next moment, that flash of consciousness is gone, this object is also gone. Next moment, there's another flash of consciousness and again this object is presented. These objects are also changing, consciousness is also changing, and changing very fast, momentary. So that's why it's called Kshanika Vijnanavada. Long before in modern literature, we had the term stream of consciousness. More than 1500 years before, great masters in India like Vasubandhu and others, they used this term as a stream of flashes of momentary consciousness. So consciousness, you are conscious, no doubt, they agree, but you are destroyed. Moment to, and not just after one lifetime, moment to moment you are being destroyed. How? By itself. By itself. And then this author argues against it. He says, no, that doesn't work. Why? Because of recognition. What is this recognition? Notice, every moment we are having experiences. And these experiences are all different from each other. I see you now, right now, this one moment. Next moment, I have this experience. I am seeing the altar. Next moment, I close my eyes. I am not seeing anything. Three experiences, one after another. And the experiences are all different. This, this, and then this. They're all different. But I immediately recognize I am the one which had each of these experiences. So the objects of experience changed. The objects of experience changed. This object, that object, no object, darkness. But the one which made all these experiences possible, that consciousness, I recognize that it did not change. I claim that it was I who had this experience, and this experience. I am the same one who's seeing, but it's the same one who's hearing also. The same one who's tasting also. The same one who's thinking also. That we all recognize. Recognition proves that the continuity of consciousness throughout all these experiences. The objects do not continue, and therefore the experiences differ. The objects are various objects are presented to awareness, and they give rise to various experiences. But awareness or consciousness does not change. The argument is recognition. Against this, of course, the mind-only school will have an immediate comeback. They will say that, yes, but that continuity which you are recognizing is an illusion. It's an illusion. Because consciousness is flashing on and off so fast, it seems like one continuous light. But it arises, then disappears, arises again, disappears again. So when you see this, this is one object, and there is its own consciousness arises along with it. Then there's a gap which is so imperceptible you don't see it. Next moment, you see this, and there's this another consciousness. And you feel the objects are different, experiences are different, but consciousness is one, but not, consciousness is not one. It came and it went. What will you say to that? We can say, if it came and it went, then in between there must have been a gap. If there is a gap, how do you know that gap? To know that gap, there must be consciousness there. If the gap has consciousness, then between this first instant, consciousness one, and consciousness three, in between the gap must be there consciousness two. If the gap also has consciousness, then consciousness one, two, three must be the same consciousness, no gap at all. And if you say, no, there is a gap, consciousness is there, then consciousness is not there, then consciousness is there again. In that case, you cannot talk about a gap, because how did you know at all if there was no consciousness at all? If you say that there is a gap, it requires it to be experienced or testified to or certified. Otherwise, you cannot speak about it. If you cannot speak about a gap, in that case, consciousness is constant. If you speak about a gap, then there was consciousness there. Again, consciousness is constant. So, consciousness is constant because we recognize it to be so. Pratyabhijnanat. See, recognition is an interesting thing. Recognition is not memory. In Sanskrit, smriti. Recognition is not perception. Right now, I am seeing you. If I remember somebody who is not here, I'm remembering that person, but I'm not seeing that person. I'm not seeing him. Recognition is both. I see you and I use my memory to recognize that, oh, it was that person. So both of them together. And when we recognize that this is the same consciousness which was there the moment ago, a day ago, 10 years ago, same consciousness. Isn't it true that there have been such tremendous changes in our life from our childhood? Maybe you don't remember our babyhood. See, recognition will not work there if you don't have memories. So we don't have memories of babyhood, maybe then we don't recognize. But childhood onwards, we have many memories. Just a few memories are necessary. Somebody asked me a question. Suppose somebody has Alzheimer's and doesn't have memory, then some memories are there. That's enough for recognition to work. So we have memories of childhood, teenage years, youth, middle age, old age. So these memories and this experience we are having now, when we put the two together, we say that that memory was generated, the consciousness which had those experiences at that time, the consciousness which is having the experiences now, I recognize it to be the same consciousness. I don't feel that was somebody else, this is somebody else. We don't feel that. That's silly. It's most obvious to us. World changed, people changed, places changed, body has changed, my mind, memory, attitudes, intellect, everything has changed. But it's still mine. We have no doubt about it. It's impossible to think it is somebody else. So, by recognition, throughout our day, this is another way in which you might say a thing disappears. We are awake here, we are experiencing this world. Very soon we will fall asleep in afternoon or night, and then we'll go into a dream world. Or right now we might fall asleep also. Don't, you'll miss out some interesting arguments. And then we wake up again. We go into a deep sleep when we wake up again. And we claim, I was awake. I dreamt. Then I was in deep sleep. I am awake again. I am the same one. I claim that dream and I claim that deep sleep. I claim this waking. Notice, the world has changed. That waking world is different from the dream world. The personality and all of that, our own narratives, they're discontinuous. We have a wake story for waking world, another story for dream world. And yet we say they were all presented to me. Which is that me? Can't be the body. Even the mind. The mind also shuts down in deep sleep. And yet, if I claim deep sleep is my experience, which is that mine?
Consciousness.
Yes, that consciousness. So we recognize that consciousness, the waking, dreaming, deep sleep. By recognition, the argument goes, you notice the indestructibility of consciousness, even the continuity of consciousness in and through all these discontinuous experiences. So, the mind-only school, very powerful opponent of continuity of consciousness. Then you have our own experiences from childhood to middle age, to youth to middle age and so on. And our daily experience of waking, dreaming, deep sleep. By recognition, we see the continuity of consciousness. Somebody might say that, all right, I'll come to that next argument a little later. The next one is, all right, it doesn't die by itself. But it can be destroyed by something else. You know, a car crash or COVID or something else. But the author says, nirangshatvat. Nothing else can destroy consciousness because consciousness does not have any parts. So here he's taking a very physicalist approach. For something to destroy something else, it must come in contact with that thing. And the body has parts. A car can come and hit it. The biological system is a machine. A virus can come and damage it and destroy it. But consciousness has no parts. Where will something else other than consciousness come into contact with consciousness? Where will it touch consciousness? You see, it's a very simple argument. Of course, later on he will show consciousness is non-dual. There is nothing other than consciousness anyway. But anyway, before that, before going off the deep end, we can just see that. How will something come in contact with consciousness? That's why Gita, Krishna says, the sword cannot cut it. You can cut a living being. You can even cleave through wood or water even. You can sort of run your sword through that. Even air, maybe you can swish your sword around. But you can't cut space, and far less cut consciousness. Krishna says, the water cannot drown it. See, flood yesterday. You can drown the body, but not consciousness. You have a very terrible experience of drowning because consciousness is not being drowned. Consciousness witnesses the drowning. It cannot be burnt. It cannot be desiccated or dried out by air. So neither air can dry it out or desiccate it. Fire cannot burn it. Water cannot drown it. The sword, weapons made of the earth element, that cannot cut it. And space, of course, is harmless. It doesn't damage anything. So consciousness, there's no contact between consciousness and anything else because consciousness does not have parts which you can contact or cut. Therefore, nothing else can impact consciousness, the awareness. Another possibility is destruction by destruction of its habitat, by its support. So an animal can be killed if the environment is damaged. Animals, the whole species will die. We, this body, if it's deprived of food or air, it can die. But consciousness, it will not die because anashrayatvat, anashrayat, the author says. Consciousness does not have any foundation. It is the foundation of everything. It is not based on anything else. So here is a big question. And this is a modern question. It did not occur to Lakshmidhara Kavi. But modern question, because we reduce everything to physical elements. We are very materialistic, physicalist. So we will immediately say, got you. Mr. Poet, ancient Sanskrit or medieval Sanskrit poet, there's something you don't know. This precious consciousness of yours, this awareness, it has a grounding. It is based on what is called the brain. You don't know about it. You are far in the past. But we know about it. Yeah. Scientists, neuroscientists, they have shown how the brain is the basis of consciousness. And when the body dies, the brain will die and lights out. That's the end of your consciousness. Because ashraya, the basis, the foundation is destroyed. And here Lakshmidhara Kavi says, anashrayat, consciousness does not have a foundation, is not rooted, is not dependent on some other substratum, some other support. Here, of course, you know, he's going to talk about the hardcore problem of consciousness. Yes, I am, but very quickly. I have belabored this point so much, flogged this particular horse to death. That's the big doubt. In this day and age, when we are living, we have a great interest in consciousness studies. And the big question is, how does the brain generate consciousness? If you could demonstrate to somebody's satisfaction that brain generates consciousness, then that would be it. Destroy the brain, destroy consciousness. Ashraya. The grounding of the consciousness is gone. The basis of consciousness is gone. But no. We might say, wait a minute. We see it all the time. When people die, go into coma, or they die, that's it, no more consciousness. But we cannot access that consciousness. How do you know that person who was conscious is gone? Right now also we are unable to access each other's consciousness. Only you have access to your own consciousness, to consciousness there. I can only see you physically, I can listen to your words, I can watch your behavior. I have no access to your, even to your thoughts. If I were a telepath, then I could access your thoughts. But even then nobody can access your consciousness as such. Even if I access your thoughts would be presented to me in my consciousness, or in me the consciousness. So consciousness is never accessed directly. If a body dies, how do you know consciousness is dead? Just because you can't interact with that person. So that is the big question. Philosopher, he was in UT Austin, I mentioned his name earlier also. I'll get the name very soon. So he wrote this nice article in New York Times saying that the hard problem of matter. He said, we have convinced ourselves that the brain produces consciousness, matter produces consciousness. And then we are puzzled about how can the brain produce consciousness, and we call it hard problem of consciousness. Strawson, Galen Strawson. If you look up New York Times and search with Galen Strawson, you'll find hard problem of matter. He says it's matter, the hard problem of matter is the big question. What is matter is the big question. Consciousness is obvious. You are all conscious. The world is presented to us in consciousness. It's because we have developed this scientific method of third person. We eliminate the observer from every scientific experiment. That's why we eliminate consciousness, we leave ourselves out of every scientific experiment observation, and we just observe the objects. That's good for science. But when the object itself is the subject, when you make the subject the object, then you cannot leave out consciousness. So, the answer to this question is, first, prove that the brain is producing consciousness. Nobody doubts there's a tight correlation between brain functioning and conscious events, like thoughts and sensations. But that the brain is producing consciousness, you have to prove it. Therefore, the conclusion is that I am eternal because I cannot be destroyed. I, the awareness, I cannot be destroyed either by myself, naswataha, or by anybody else. Nacha anyataha, or by destruction of my basis or my foundation or my substratum. Nacha ashraya vinashat. So, all of these are not possible. Therefore, I, the consciousness, am eternal. So, this is the argument. Then Abhi say, okay, wise guy, you may be eternal, but consciousness, Brahman, is supposed to be all pervasive. You're supposed to be everywhere. You clearly are not everywhere. You're only in that particular chair. You're only standing right there, not everywhere. Brahman is all pervading. You cannot have any space limitation. You have just proven what? You've tried to prove that you do not have time limitation. But what about space limitation? Are you everywhere? Sarvavyapi? And the author replies, he says, Abharupasya Vishvasya Bhanam bhasan nidhirvina kadachit navakalpeta bhachaham tena sarvagaha. Very elegant poetry also. His answer is that this. The non-conscious universe, the non-sentient universe, can never be experienced without contact with consciousness. But it is experienced. Therefore, I am everywhere in the universe. We say, wait a minute, what did you say? Are you trying to pull a fast one on us? The example he's using is this. We'll understand it at three different levels. It's a subtle argument. First is a very simple approach. First pass at this argument is this. In this room, there are so many things. If you switch off the light, it'll all be in darkness. But when you switch on the light, we will see all these chairs and people and everything. But ask yourself, why are things in darkness? Why do we need light? Because all these things are not luminous. They're not luminous. These objects, chairs and tables and all, they are not luminous. They are covered in darkness until light reveals them. Step one. Step two. So that is that's meaning of the Sanskrit. Abharupasya Vishvasya, the non-shining universe. Bhasannidhervina, without connection with light. Bhasa, nasambhavati, that its illumination is not possible. So, this room which is in darkness, you cannot see it unless it is illumined by light. Step one. Step two. You switch on the light, there is only one light. That is luminous. We know this is the source of light. How do you know? You don't need another light to illuminate this. And that is luminous. But when we switch on the light, suddenly everything here becomes revealed. Which means this light must have traveled everywhere and illumined everything else. See, those objects cannot be seen unless they reflect light, unless they are in contact with light. They do not have their own light. This one has its own light. Now, when you switch this one, you can see this, but amazingly, you suddenly see everything else also. Which means this light is pervading the entire room, and this light and all this light is pervading the entire room and revealing everything. So everything comes into contact with light and then it shines. You see the steps of the argument. Things in the universe do not have light, in this room do not have light of their own. Without light of their own, you cannot see them. But we are seeing. In that case, they are in contact with light. But where did the light come from? Because they don't have light of their own. There's only one thing which has light of its own, the light. That means this light must be in contact with everything in this room. So the light is all pervading in the room. Wherever you are, there's illumination, there must be contact with light. If those things are non-luminous. Similarly, this entire universe is object. It has no consciousness of its own. It cannot be experienced without consciousness. Experience requires consciousness plus object is equal to experience. C plus O is equal to E. Consciousness plus object is equal to experience. All our experiences are basically the same equation. C plus O is equal to E. I'll patent that. Yes, it's the most important equation of our lives. That's what makes all life, all experience, worldly, spiritual, everything possible. True. We'll see. We'll go there. We will remove the O very soon. Hold on. But right now, consciousness plus object is equal to experience. If you remove consciousness, suppose, object itself will not generate experience because it's not self-luminous. So, whenever we have experience of object, there must be contact with consciousness. And we experience the universe. You are the only conscious thing. Experience of the universe requires consciousness, so your consciousness must be pervading this universe. Curious example. Mm-hmm. And we may have lots of questions. Yes, that's true, but only in this room, you know, this is what I see, hear, smell, taste, touch. Beyond this, there's such a vast universe. There is New York and America and the world and the universe. I don't see any of it. So how is my consciousness pervading everything? Then you'll have to draw a distinction between consciousness and knowledge. I'll just put it out there in brief and then move on. So there's a distinction between consciousness and knowledge. What am I trying to explain? I'm trying to explain, if I, the consciousness, pervade the entire universe, how come I don't know everything all at once? Knowledge is a special case of conscious experience. So right now, I experience this, means I see you all, but I don't see what's behind me. How do I see you all? I, the consciousness, through the mind and using the instruments of the eyes, I deploy these instruments and see you. But this is strictly limited. This much only I can see. Now, what is behind me? I redeploy my eyes. My consciousness and mind are there and I see what's behind me. But now I can't see you. So my knowledge, the range of my knowledge is limited. What happens is, a tiny slice of this universe passes from the unknown to the known when we focus our instruments of knowledge, eyes, ears, scientific instruments. The moment we refocus them, that passes into the unknown or into memory. But all of it is in consciousness as the known and the unknown. I cannot not repeat this. It's a very profound insight. Everything in the universe is in your consciousness, either as known or unknown. When you say there is a vast unknown thing, how can I be conscious? You are already conscious of it as a vast unknown thing. I made this more obvious by the story I often tell about Bill Conrad. He is 99 now. Yeah. So he has this question. Swami, things are not in our consciousness. Things exist and then we come to it as conscious beings. So this is what is called a realist perspective. physicalist perspective. The room is there. It's not in our consciousness or in your consciousness. We come as conscious beings and then we experience the room. This is a common sense approach, also a realist approach or materialist approach. And he said, I will prove it to you. I'll set up this camera and we will take pictures of this room. And we will all go out of this room. When I come back into the room, I will show you the camera with the pictures and you will see an empty room without any conscious being. So proving thereby the room existed without any conscious being. You or I, we were not there. So I said to him, Bill, in your consciousness, you saw this room. In your consciousness, you set up this experiment. In your consciousness, you put a camera and you invited me to come outside with you. In your consciousness, we came back into the room. In your consciousness, you opened the camera and showed me the picture of an empty room. At which point did you step outside your consciousness? In your consciousness, there was an empty room. But in your consciousness only. Think about it. It's a very subtle point. But a very simple point all at the same time. Everything in our lives is in consciousness. Known and unknown. It may not be known. For example, you are looking at me right now. A simple experiment. You are all looking at me. You are seeing me right now. And you are there and you are seeing me. Suppose you close your eyes. You can try it right now. And now you are not seeing me. Clearly you are not seeing me if you close your eyes. But if I ask you, are you still there? What would you say? Yes, I am there. And if you were not to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, presumably you would still be there. If you were not even to dream, remember, if all your feelings were neutral, neither very painful nor very pleasant, even then you would be there. Claim in Advaita Vedanta is you are there in the dream also. You, the awareness, are there in deep sleep also. Deep sleep is less like closing the eyes, just closing every faculty. You are still there. But if you were not there, none of this would be experienced. As the known and the unknown. So, this is the first level of understanding. It's already pretty deep. The first level of understanding is clearly the universe is experienced as the known and the unknown. It's all experienced in consciousness. Another way of understanding this would be, are you trying to say the universe, your consciousness, you know, pervades all of space? It seems a little odd. Millions and millions of light years, your consciousness is going out there and pervading. Even light takes millions of years. So consciousness goes all out there. No, what is meant here, second, a deeper level of understanding is, it's not that, like this room, there's a room and you switch on the light, light pervades this room. Even that is not instantaneous. It takes a tiny, tiny little bit of time for it to pervade. You know, light also has a finite speed. It's not like there is a space and consciousness pervades the space. No, that's not what Advaita is saying. Rather, something even more radical than that. It says even space appears in consciousness. Space appears in consciousness. How do you understand this? Think about our dreams. Suppose in our dreams we were walking in a nice garden, like that park next door. We were walking in a nice garden. And you saw plants and lakes and sky and path and people and space all around. Now all of that is imagined by the dreaming mind, isn't it? Will you say that there is this space of that dream garden and then the mind goes and pervades all of it? No, you will say that the whole thing was imagined in the mind. Similarly, the claim in Advaita Vedanta is all of space is an appearance in your mind. In consciousness. In that sense, consciousness pervades. Not like this light now pervading this room. Not that the room exists in darkness, light comes and pervades the room. That's first level of understanding. The second level of understanding is, use the dream example. The whole of time and space actually appears in consciousness. And it's true also. If you coolly think about it, where else does it appear? Where else do you experience it? All of life is experienced. The stage is consciousness only. Now, we will go on to the third level of understanding. So, this is the second argument to prove. This argument wants to prove that you are not limited in space. Because everything in space is revealed by consciousness. So, consciousness pervades all of space. Or deeper understanding, space itself appears in consciousness. Therefore, space cannot be a limitation to consciousness. Then, one last objection. But Brahman is non-dual. Advaitam. Is consciousness non-dual? Clearly, consciousness is not non-dual, because you all along you have been speaking about consciousness and object giving you experience. Didn't you just say, Swami, you patented your own equation, C plus O is equal to E, therefore there is something other than consciousness, and that which is appearing to consciousness. Therefore, its consciousness is not non-dual. There is a second thing. The second thing is the entire universe. That's a big second thing. So it's not non-dual. The poet now says,
Nahi sattvam rite bhanam, nahi,
or other way around,
nahi bhanam rite sattvam, narte bhanam chito chitaha, chitsam bandhopina. Chit sambandho pinadhyasat rite tenaham advayah.
What does it mean? Without consciousness, without the shining forth, you cannot talk about existence of entities. And this non-luminous universe, this non-shining universe, cannot be revealed without consciousness. This is just rehearsing the argument which we just did. Nothing new. We just did this. This entire universe is non-conscious object. It cannot be experienced without consciousness. That's all he's saying. Non-shining universe does not shine without light, without consciousness. Na rite chitaha achitaha bhanam. Then, now the big question comes. Chit sambandhopi. Chit sambandhopi na adhyasadrite. The connection with consciousness is not possible without superimposition. Therefore, I am non-dual. Really deep and powerful and difficult argument he makes here. What is it? So, let me put it very precisely. What is he trying to prove? Consciousness is non-dual. And you are consciousness. Therefore, you are non-dual. Consciousness is non-dual. How is he trying to prove it? He's asking, why do you think consciousness is dual, more than one entity is there? Well, because you said consciousness plus object is our experience. I see you. I am having this experience. Clearly, then you are different from me. So duality is there. Now he's asking the question, what is the relationship between consciousness and object? Swami, you said C plus O. What is the relationship between C and O? This is the big question. And in philosophy, in Indian philosophy, we come across many answers to that. One answer is that the O, the object, generates consciousness. Object is the cause, consciousness is the effect. Who says that? Materialist. The scientist who claims, the materialist, physicalist who claims, brain is generating consciousness. So object generates consciousness. That's one answer. That's the materialist answer. Or consciousness generates the object. The entire universe is created by consciousness. Who says that? The theist. All religions which worship God. What's the definition of God in any religion? Creator of the universe. Imani bhutani jayante. All these beings arise out of Brahman. So Brahman is the cause of the universe. Consciousness is the cause. Consciousness produces this universe. A third theory is, neither produces the other. Consciousness and object are parallel entities. Who says this? The Sankhyan. There is consciousness here. And there is this material universe. And they coexist together. Consciousness gives you first person experience. And the material universe is what is experienced. C plus O is equal to E. Perfect. That equation, you should take it literally. Who says this? The Sankhya philosopher. The yoga philosopher. And our very own, in this day and age, in New York, NYU, David Chalmers. Panpsychism, that consciousness is a ubiquitous reality in this universe, cannot be reduced to matter. So that what is he then claiming? He's not claiming matter is false or matter is produced by consciousness. Matter and energy are there, consciousness is also there. Another fundamental reality of the universe, and they all exist together. It's called panpsychism. Another theory would be the Buddhist theory. consciousness and object arise and fall together, which we saw a little earlier, the mind-only theory. A little further than that, the emptiness school, the Shunyavadi. So neither consciousness is real nor the object is real. Both appear and disappear together. Finally, the Advaitic theory, the fifth one. The Advaitic theory is that consciousness is real and the object is an appearance in consciousness. It's not that the object is also real, the consciousness is real, and both are interacting somehow. That's Sankhya. It's not that consciousness alone is real and it is producing an object, something actually coming out of it. That's theistic religion, any God-worshipping religion. And it's certainly not the other way around, that matter is real and is producing consciousness. That is physicalism or materialism. The poet here is claiming, Chit sambandhopina adhyasadrite. Without the appearance, without the theory of superimposition, there is no possibility of connection with consciousness. An object can have no relationship with consciousness other than superimposition. Let me explain this in two ways. One is the easy way and one is the difficult but the important one. The easy way is this. According to Advaita Vedanta also, the Brahman is the cause of this universe. Like any religion says, worships God. Brahman is that from which the universe is produced. But then the cause and the effect have a non-dual relationship. What does it mean by that? In the ocean, you see 10,000 waves. But they are all water. If you count the waves, you will have thousands and thousands of waves. But if you count water, then you cannot count the waves as something other than water. You can't say water and 10,000 waves. There are 10,001 things. No. If you count water, there's only one thing. Then what about those thousands of waves? They do not constitute a countable second apart from the water. Why not? Because the water is the material out of which all those waves are made. How can you count the material and the product together? It will be double counting. You'll be audited. You'll be caught by the IRS. You're double counting. This podium. The wood, you cannot say, you're using two words. Are there two things here? No, there's just one. So why can't you say it's the podium? Not the wood. Because the wood was there before the podium, wood is there now, wood will be there after the podium is one day destroyed. The podium is just a name and a form, a shape given to this wood and a use which we put it for. But the wood continues here. With respect to the wood, follow this carefully. With respect to the wood, the podium does not constitute a countable second. With respect to the wood, the podium is not a second. Nadvaitam, non-dual, advaitam. This is, the wood is advaitam, non-dual with respect to the podium. Of course, this is wood advaitam, wood non-duality. We are not talking about that, otherwise you'll be wooden headed. We are talking about consciousness non-duality. So, Brahman is the cause, and the universe is the effect. Brahman, just like the podium is the effect and the wood is the cause, therefore podium is countably not second apart from the wood. Similarly, Brahman is the cause, universe is the effect, universe is not a second reality apart from Brahman, because everything that is actually none other than Brahman. This is an argument from cause and effect, karya-karan, this argument. But this is not what the poet is trying to talk about here. This is the easy way out. But remember, this also takes the way through the Upanishads. That how do you know Brahman is the cause? Well, the Upanishads say from which the entire universe has arisen. This is not the strategy of the poet throughout this text. He relies on argument and only argument. He will not say, refer back to a text and see, use that text as a way of leveraging your argument. No. He says, forget that. Go back to the equation. Consciousness plus object is experience. But now we are asking, what is the relationship between consciousness and object? And notice, consciousness and object are entirely different, diametrically opposite things. Shankaracharya says in his introduction to the Brahma Sutra Bhashya, he says, Tamap prakashavad viruddha swabhavayoho. Consciousness and object, he says, Yushmad asmat pratyaya gocharayo vishaya vishayini tamap prakashavad viruddha svabhavayo. Consciousness and object, he says, they are the knower and the known. and they constitute diametrically opposite characteristics, natures, like light and darkness. There can be no connection between them. If you take light, the darkness will go away. That funny story is there of the man in the village who told the servant at night, here is a lantern, go see where there's darkness and put it there. And the man went around and came back, sir, I did not find any darkness. Wherever I went, there was no darkness at all. Darkness and light do not coexist together. Wherever you take light, darkness flees. In fact, it's a very cute insight into the nature of consciousness. You keep on comparing consciousness with light, but consciousness is more than light. Physical light and darkness cannot coexist. But consciousness and darkness can coexist because it's to consciousness that darkness is revealed. So the beautiful way of putting it is, consciousness can illumine even darkness. I mean, physical darkness. Now, object and subject, consciousness and object, are of diametrically different natures, like light and darkness. It's consciousness which illumines the object. There can be no relationship between them. A good example of this is the Descartesian mind-body dualism, which has bedeviled the philosophy of mind in the West for the last 300 years, more than 300 years. So Descartes said that his conclusion was, I think, therefore I exist. The one thing you cannot doubt is that you think. What is this thinking? It is mind. And it's very different from body. Yeah. Body is an object. Clearly, there are two different things. Because body is a public object. I can see you and your doctor can probe and examine what is inside. So it's a public object. Others can see it also. You can see it also. But your mind is available only to you on a first person basis. Mind and body are two very different entities according to Descartes. Now that led to a huge question of how do they interact? Clearly they are interacting. I am thinking of some words and then such a complex vocal mechanism is executing my thoughts and speaking. This is body clearly. And the thoughts are thoughts. But they are interacting somehow. I think I'm going to raise my hand. Here, I raised my hand. So the body and the thoughts, they interacted. But how? Where? Why is this such a big problem? Since body and mind are so different, where will they come in contact? When they come in contact, is that body or mind? That point of contact. Descartes had a student, a Princess Elizabeth, I think. And she was very interested in science and philosophy in those days, 300 years ago. And she used to correspond with long letters with Descartes. And those letters make very interesting reading. She raises this question. He says, Monsieur Descartes, I being a woman of poor feminine intellect, it is beyond me to understand. That's how they wrote in those days. She is very much a feminist, you'll see. It's beyond me to understand how this mind, this which seems to be a spiritual thing, and the body which is so physical, how would they connect? How would they interact? But clearly they are interacting. And Descartes was in a fix because he knew the problem. He was sort of skirting around it. He said, see, there is something in the brain called the pineal gland. That's where the mind and the brain interact. And she wrote back immediately. He won't let him go. She has pinned him down. She says, yes, but it's my poor woman's intellect. I failed to grasp because the pineal gland is very much physical. It's part of the brain. So where in the pineal gland can the mind come and touch the brain? Then Descartes was pushed into a corner. He invented this theory of vapors. There are vapors in the brain which the mind can push around. And the vapors will push the pineal gland, which will push your body around. So that was long before modern neuroscience. But it shows the mind-body interaction problem, which has not been solved till now. No, we have made no progress at all. All our most sophisticated instruments, what will they show? Little electrical activity in the brain, in the neurons there. That's still body. That's still physical. Where is the mind there? How is those electrical activities, how are they connected to the mind? Where? So this is a problem with mind-body interaction. Same problem, much more difficult, consciousness-object interaction. Even mind is an object, because thoughts are objects. How are objects related to consciousness? And you'll notice one thing. This entire universe, even physically also, when we are experiencing this universe, notice how the transformation happens. All of you I'm seeing, but how? Through the eyes. But you are not entering into my eyes. You have to call 911. All that enters my eyes is light, reflected from you all. Only light comes to the eyes. And instantly, no light also. From the optic nerves, little bursts of electricity are racing to the optic nerve centers, optic centers in the brain. So, it's all little bursts of electricity in the brain. And then it becomes visual sensation, which is like what we call perception, pratyaksha. At that point, people are not there. Light is not there. Electricity is not there. When it comes to the mind, it is mind only. Notice, whole universe, whatever it is, when it comes to the eyes, it is light only. When it comes to the brain, it is electrical impulses only. When it comes to the mind, it is mind only. When it is mind is presented to consciousness, it is consciousness only. What the author is saying is, how does consciousness experience the object? How does it connect with the object? It's impossible, and yet it does. How does it do so? The objects are appearances in consciousness. It is consciousness experiencing itself only in the form, name, form, and functioning of these objects. If you ask, what are they made of? When I see you right now, I'm seeing you in my awareness, you're all arising in my awareness. What are they made of? Are these people I'm seeing in my awareness, are they made of cells, blood, flesh? No, no, no. Right now, even no doctor, no scientist will also deny this. In the experience of the person, there are not physical bodies, vehicles and trees and activities going on. No, it is all consciousness. At the level of consciousness, at the level of mind, it is all mind. At the level of brain, it is all electrical activity of the neurons. At the level of eyes, it is all light. So, as far as consciousness goes, for consciousness to experience an object, the object can be nothing other than an appearance in consciousness, nothing other than consciousness. Let's put it this way. See at which point you agree and which point you stop agreeing. The whole world, all your life, all our lives, our experience is the world appearing to consciousness. Step one. I think everybody will be on board with this. This is how we experience life. Second, the whole world, whatever we experience, is appearing not only to consciousness, but in consciousness. Some of you will agree. Some will not agree. What do you mean in consciousness? Well, consciousness is clearly here, and that is out. Once in Haridwar, one monk in a class like this said from the back of the hall, when the teacher was saying, you are consciousness, you are all pervading, aap sarva vyapi ho, the person in the back, he said, wait a minute, Mahatma ji, aap udhar hain, hum idhar hain, udhar nahi hai, sarva vyapi kaise hue, yahan hain, wahan nahi hai, sarva vyapi kaise hue, I am here, I am not there, how can I be all pervading? And the teacher answered, और यहाँ और वहाँ क्या दोनों ही आप में नहीं है? Here and there, are they not both in you? What does it mean? Are they not both experienced in you, the awareness? Even the sense of here and there, space. Suppose you were dreaming. Here is my friend. Or there is another friend coming from far off. But when you wake up, here and there, both were appearances in your dream. It's not actually there was a lot of space in your brain. No matter how empty. Okay, sir. So, here and there, both are appearances in consciousness. That's the second step. The whole world appears not only to consciousness, but in consciousness. Another way of understanding this, that everything appears in consciousness, in your consciousness, or you, the consciousness, is we have a feeling, no, it is outside my consciousness. Where is the limit to consciousness, if you ask? Many people understand in this way. See, where is the limit to the body? Here. Beyond this, it's not my body. This is the limit of my body, up to my skin. Where is the limit of the room? Up to there. Beyond those windows and doors, it's not this room. But where is the limit to consciousness? If you think in that way, this is in my awareness, this is in the awareness, in consciousness for me. This is all in consciousness. That is also in consciousness. In consciousness, the sense of distance is also in consciousness. The sense of a vast world beyond every my perception is also in consciousness. Where does consciousness stop and something else begin? Outside consciousness. If you were conscious of that, then it would be inside consciousness. If you were not conscious of that, you would not even speak about it. Consciousness has no limit. Everything appears in consciousness as the known or the unknown. and then he's taking the next step. Then that which appears to you in you, the consciousness, what is your relationship with it? He says the only relationship with it is these are appearances in consciousness. Nahi chit sambandho, nahi adhyasa adrite. This appearance theory is called superimposition. Adhyasa. Like the snake and the rope. The rope is real. We mistake it for a snake. Consciousness is real. You're mistaking it for a world. Apart from consciousness. If you see it as consciousness appearing as the world, you're right. You don't have to make the world disappear. If the world is appearing to consciousness, in consciousness as nothing but consciousness, can you count it as a second reality apart from consciousness? No way. Thank you. No way. It is not countable as a second reality apart from you, the consciousness, not second, non-dual, advaitam, non-dual. You, the consciousness, are non-dual. Tenaham advayam. Chit sambandho api na adhyasadrite. Connection with, relationship with, connection with consciousness is not possible without appearance, without superimposition. Tenaham aham advayah. Therefore, I am non-dual. Hence proved QED. See, to sum up everything, he started off by saying, I exist, I shine, and I am dear to myself. Therefore, I am Brahman, Satchidananda. Then our question was, wait a minute, not so fast. You must prove that you are eternal. And he proved that he is eternal by showing that I, the consciousness, am indestructible, neither by myself because of recognition, neither by anything else because of lack of contact, neither by destruction of the foundation because there is no foundation. Consciousness is not produced by the brain, it's a it's a fundamental reality. Then the next question was all-pervading. And he proved it by saying, experience, we are experiencing the universe, but experience means contact with consciousness. Therefore, the universe is in contact with consciousness, just like light pervading the room. Or even deeper, space itself is an appearance, something experienced in consciousness. Therefore, space cannot limit consciousness. Therefore, I am all-pervading. Are you non-dual? You have to show there is nothing else other than you, the consciousness. He says, yes, I can show that. Because the entire universe, which is non-luminous, appears. If it appears, it must be in contact with consciousness. It is appearing to consciousness, in consciousness, and nothing but consciousness. This nothing but consciousness, C plus O is equal to E. Consciousness plus object is equal to experience. But what is this plus? Is it adding a second thing to consciousness, or is it an appearance in consciousness? When we have dreams, are there people and houses and lakes all in the head actually? No. Impossible. That's crazy. They are all appearances in the mind. They are all imagined in the mind. They are all dreamt objects. If they are dreamt objects, are they anything but the mind? What is the relationship between a tree you saw in the dream and your dreaming mind? Was there a tree planted in your mind with roots and branches? And no. It was your mind appearing as a tree. Similarly, the universe is appearing to us in consciousness. It's consciousness alone appearing as the universe. The universe, no entity in the universe, is a countable second apart from consciousness, you, the consciousness. So consciousness is non-dual. Good. Therefore, I am Sat, Chit, Ananda. The definition given in Taittiriya Upanishad stands vindicated not just for Brahman, for you. Satyam jnanam anantam brahma. Brahman is infinite existence consciousness. You are infinite in existence consciousness. I am infinite existence consciousness. Eternal, all-pervasive, non-dual. Okay, that's a heavy load of arguments and metaphysics. So many arguments. Yeah, you just think about it. Yeah. All for us. I'll end with this. All of these arguments, what's the value? In Panchadashi, the great master Vidyaranya, he says, what is the status of this world? He says, for the enlightened one, it doesn't exist. It's consciousness alone. Tuccha. It's alone, Brahman alone. Nothing other than Brahman is there. Consciousness alone. Though it appears to be a different thing. Though we interact in it. Even in the midst of life, in the midst of experience, midst of enjoyment, suffering, it is non-dual. Not that all the waves in the ocean have to subside, then only it is water. Even when all the waves are there, even tsunami waves are there, it's still water. Even when life is difficult, it's still you, the completely placid, undisturbed consciousness. Always. So this is the claim that he is making, that we are this non-dual consciousness all the time. Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. I pray to Sri Sri Thakur, Ma and Swamiji, by their blessings may we realize this, something which is directly present to us all the time, effortlessly. Swami Vivekananda called it an open secret. It's present to us all the time. And our lives will be blessed by this greatest and most final of realizations. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.